This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Several of the primary races in Texas failed to produce a clear winner. With seven candidates on the Republican ballot in the state's 19th congressional district, many expected a runoff. And after more than 77,000 West Texans cast their ballots, Tom Sell emerged as the leader in the field, with Matt Smith within less than a percentage point of Abraham Enriquez to claim the other spot on that runoff ballot. Tom Sell had captured 40% of primary votes and knew, on election night, while he didn't win outright, he would be on the runoff ballot.
In fact, I talked to several of the other candidates who said, let's try and be an example to the rest of the nation in this competition. And so compliments to them. We're going to continue to do it that way and just continue to get around the district and build these friendships and relationships and listen to the issues and try and speak and engage in wise and thoughtful ways with them, because we want to talk about the issues and engage with people across the district and listen to them about what are their issues and needs and wants and fears and hopes and all that stuff. And I think generally our campaign, and I'm talking about all the other candidates as well, it's generally been mostly positive.
Abraham Enriquez shared his enthusiasm for the next phase of the election season with us.
In West Texas, you know, we keep things about policy. We keep things about values. I think that's what makes our elections more exciting, is that they're based on principle, not character, assassination or getting crazy. And that's something that I actually admire about West Texas politics. And, you know, I've had conversation with my opponent, and we're going to keep it that way. We're going to keep it about policy. Well, we certainly are. We couldn't be polar opposites. I'm running up against someone who has been a part of the political machine for a couple decades now. As a lobbyist, my opponent understands how to navigate what is the swamp. And I'm definitely different from that. I'm someone that is a little bit more fresh, a little bit more new. I would say that I am more on the newly America First MAGA candidate. And I think for voters, that makes it a little easier when it comes to going to the election box and seeing who you're going to stand for. And I think that makes it easier in the runoff, knowing that those are the two campaigns on the ballot.
Fewer than 200 votes separated Enriquez from Matt Smith. Here's what Matt Smith told KACU.
If I believed everything I heard, I would have zero trust in the election process. I have people that are telling me that they believe the election's stolen. They believe, you know, there's fraud going on. And my answer to all of it has been, bring me some proof and I'll look at it. I have no desire to get caught up in the dramatic or what you could consider conspiracy theories if there's not any actual proof. I'm not looking to have it to where, you know, some people would call it like a sore loser. I'm not looking to be in a spot that says, okay, I was, 193 votes down, so I'm going to cry, it's stolen, it's, you know, fraud, any of that, if there isn't any proof of it. And honestly, the best candidate, I believe, is going to come out and win this. And regardless of who it is in May, come November, we're all going to be in support of them and cheering them along. So don't cannibalize our party and start being so mean and tearing the other people down that we forget that this is niched in and we are all very similar whenever it comes to the way that we're looking at things here.
Candidates who are in a runoff have until March 18th to withdraw. The runoff election will be May 26. Only those who voted in the Republican primary will be eligible to cast a ballot in the runoff. We have asked Drew Landry, Assistant Professor of Government at South Plains College, to give us his thoughts on this race. Professor Landry, thank you for joining us on the West Texas Dispatch.
Always good to be with you, George. Thanks for having me on.
All right, we have got ourselves a runoff. Tell us what your overall view of the race is for the Republican nomination for the 19th Congressional District.
This was a bit on pause for a little while because we were really unsure as to who was going to come into second place here. But, you know, but as it's looked, this is going to be between Tom Sell and Abraham Enriquez, both from Lubbock. And, you know, it's interesting as to how this works out with this runoff. And I think it would be wise for them to really seek out an endorsement from Matt Smith to kind of put them over the edge and to really get them this full-on nomination. It was a hard-fought campaign. I mean, you know, what really was interesting was how Congressman Arrington just rather abruptly said he wasn't going to run for re-election, and that put everybody in a bit of a tizzy. And so you had these candidates, you know, try to make a name out of themselves in a very quick order. And, you know, those three, the Tom Sell, Abraham Enriquez, and Matt Smith worked really, really hard, as did the others, but they seemed to be really the top tier. And it looks like Matt Smith can be the kingmaker, the nominee maker, if you will, in this runoff.
Well, let me ask you this quick question. It was so close between second and third. Do you see any point in requesting a recount for Matt Smith?
I don't think that'd be a bad idea. And he's well within that threshold to do that. The question would be, is it a financial decision for him to really do that? Because if he doesn't either tie or win that, you know, to really, you know, to come in second, he would have to probably pay for that entire recount according to Texas law. So I think he might be thinking about that, and I don't think that's a bad idea. But you know, he's got some decisions to make here in the next week or so to really see if he really did come out to be the second place winner. So I think that might be the reason he hasn't fully conceded yet, but numbers are what they are.
Well, speaking of money, Tom Sell, he outraised his competitors by a really wide margin. How much does money matter in this race?
So, great question, George. It's a really important aspect, but it's not everything. You know, what we often like to think is that the campaign war chest gets you access to voters because of all the things you get to buy with it, whether it be TV ads, radio ads, direct mailers, you know, signs. And the more money you have, the more ability you have to advertise for yourself. But at the same time, you know, you also can't solely rely on money to do it for you. You got to put the groundwork in. So it does mean a lot, but at the same time, you can't rest on that laurel that you have so much money. You got to go out there and knock on those doors and go to those festivals and really try to convince people to vote for you other than just through an ad.
Tom Sell may have the money. Abraham Enriquez seems to have some of the key endorsements, including Governor Abbott. How much are those worth?
Some, you know, they're nothing to really sneeze at, but, you know, you have to think about what they really meant in this primary, because if they were a big, big deal, you know, he would have came in a lot closer. So when you think about how that really played out, it didn't really seem like voters really cared about that to the tune of whether or not they would have had access to, you know, a key committee or having, you know, knowing how the bread is made, as what Tom Sell was really bringing out. So while endorsements from key people like the governor are important, they're only important to an extent.
I think runoffs can be weird. There's no other way to put it. You know, you get fewer mm-hmm. people that are allowed to vote. In fact, only Republicans who voted in the general or in the Republican primary can vote in the runoff. How does that affect these kinds of races when they come down to the end?
A candidate has to convince not only his people who voted for him the first time to come out again, but you got to convince other people who may have supported other candidates to come out and support you. So you got to you have to remind your key set of supporters to come out again. And that's a big deal, because a lot of voters just may not really be paying attention to the fact that they would have to come out for a second round in late May. So that's a big deal. You know, that's a really big, big thing there. So, you know, that's why I was kind of saying that, you know, Matt Smith and a few of these others may play a key role in deciding who could be the next nominee based on their key set of supporters. And so with that sort of tandem there, they could tag team and help their supporters come out for a particular candidate. And again, the main thing is you have to remind them, hey, look, we are in this again. You got to come out again, and I have to get more people out on my side. And that's where that ground game comes in. That's where that money comes in to advertise for yourself.
Yeah. Sell had so many more votes than Enriquez did in this first round. Does Enriquez have a legitimate chance?
So this is wild. I mean, you mentioned about how runoffs are just weird earlier. This is even more weird. Because when we look at some as to how some of these runoffs have worked in the past, it seems like if you come in first, that's like the kiss of death. It's like that's your ceiling. So those who might come in second might have a bit of a chance to kind of get more key sets of supporters. And so while that it has been wild in the past, it seems right now that may not always be the case. So you asked me, does Enriquez have a real chance? The answer is yes. But you know, he's got some sets of controversies he has to get through. He has to convince some people to come onto his side. You know, there's, you know, a fourth, fifth place people who could possibly bring him a coalition of supporters to really go up against Tom Cell. You know, and that's for him and his campaign to really make this out. But you're right, George. I mean, the momentum, it seems, is with Tom Cell, based on the money, based on the key set of support that he got in the primary, and his ability to remind them to come out again is definitely on his side. But you never say never in elections. Anything can happen.
Drew Landry, thank you for sharing your insight with us today.
Thank you for having me on. Always good to be with you, George.
Drew Landry is Assistant Professor of Government at South Plains College in Lubbock. Officially, it's called the Farm, Food, and National Security Act of 2026, but we usually refer to it as the Farm Bill. The House Agricultural Committee advanced the legislation, which, among other things, strengthens safety nets for commodities. It expands crop insurance, it increases credit limits for farmers, and it tightens SNAP work requirements. We have asked Laramie Adams, Associate Director of Government Affairs for Texas Farm Bureau, to give us some perspective on how this will affect one of the largest sectors of the West Texas economy. Laramie, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and always good to be with you to discuss agriculture.
Well, I know farmers, ranchers, those who work with them have been waiting for this farm bill to make some progress. Yes, is this a good bill, you think, for West Texas?
Yes, absolutely. We have definitely been working on this for over 3 years now, and actually it may be about 3 years that we've been working to try to get ultimately a new safety net delivered for our farmers and ranchers who are working in really unprecedented times. So yes, it's a very good bill, and something that we want to see finalized and pressed across the House floor before the entire House of U.S. Representatives, and then also sent over to the Senate and eventually signed by the President. We know that our farmers and ranchers can't wait any longer.
What are the key things the agricultural industry is looking for with this bill?
Well, so in reconciliation, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, now called the Working Families Tax Cut Act, that bill had a lot of your crop insurance and actual farm safety net provisions included, mm-hmm. which are a lot of the farm programs that our farmers and ranchers rely on as they farm and ranch, as they plant seed, and also try to make it through the growing season. You know, the farmers and ranchers recently, especially here in Texas, have really, like I said, faced unprecedented times with high input costs, low commodity prices, and just a number of things stacked against them. So it's important that, and we've been saying this for a while, it's very important that we upgrade the safety net and make sure that that the current policy actually fits the environment that our farmers and ranchers are trying to farm in. So a lot of those provisions were included in reconciliation. And now you have what a lot of people are calling Farm Bill 2.0, or Chairman G.T. Thompson's Farm, Food, and National Security Act of 2026, that just really goes in and finishes up what was not done in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So this includes a lot of conservation and energy programs, some livestock and dairy, trade, rural development, nutrition, and other key policy changes. So we're hopeful that this will get done to actually once and for all deliver a full and upgraded farm bill to our producers.
Laramie, one of the provisions that's caused some controversy is the establishment of uniform national pesticide labeling that prevents states from imposing some stricter labeling laws. How do Texas ag producers feel about that?
Well, I mean, you look at our ag producers, and like I said, they're already faced with a number of challenges. And one of the things that can always help them is reduced regulatory burden. So anything that we can do that would help farmers and ranchers operate under less regulation is always a good thing, because that red tape, it gets caught up in just trying to navigate it, but then also the cost of trying to navigate it as well. And I'll tell you, the one thing that we always tell folks is that when you look at pesticides, our farmers are the first to know that food safety is extremely important to not only the consumers of this world, but also to their own families. And they're not going to be doing anything that's going to harm them. So creating some uniformity is always a welcome thing, as long as it accomplishes the ultimate goal of reduced regulation and allows our farmers to do what they do best.
Laramie, no bill is perfect, and no bill is going to make everybody happy. You're hearing from members. What are some things that they're disappointed with or wish had been better?
I'll tell you, the main thing that they're disappointed with is that it's taken so long for Congress to, you know, come together and actually get this done, and it's still not done. You know, I think that, yes, while we are very, very excited and, you know, grateful that the House Ag Committee has done their job of getting it out of committee, most of our folks are just really disappointed that it's taken this much time and effort to try to get it done. We all know that farm security is national security, or we should all know, and we want these members of Congress to understand that. This should have been something that was done years ago when the 2018 Farm Bill was expiring. So I think that's been the biggest frustration that we've heard from our members, is just, when is this going to get done? And why are we still waiting? So we have at Texas Farm Bureau been really pushing the message of that, you know, like I said, farm security being national security, but then also this is not just a bill that impacts rural Texas or rural America. It impacts very, very urban areas too, because last I checked, they like to eat as well. So, you know, we've really been spending a lot of time educating members of Congress on the importance of getting this done. So I would say that has been the biggest challenge, has been just explaining to our members, or trying to explain to them, why the delay. And they are warranted concerns of the delay, especially when it should be something that is top priority.
Well, Laramie, speaking of delays, it's not easy to get anybody in Congress together. Definitely not to get easy to both sides together. Where are you on the process, and what are your feelings about this getting through the House and the Senate and the president?
Well, we have a very, we're excited to see that it was passed out of committee with a pretty strong bipartisan support. So with eight Democrats on the Ag Committee actually coming and voting in favor of the bill to get it out of committee. You know, it could have been passed on a purely partisan line, and luckily that wasn't the case. You know, I think folks understand that we do need to work in a bipartisan fashion in agriculture to get the ultimate goal accomplished. So that's a very positive first step, is that there was that bipartisan support coming out of the committee markup. Now, the job that we have is continuing to, you know, beat the bushes to make sure that Republican leadership knows that this bill needs to go to the floor or get into some sort of must-pass legislation to get this across the goal line. And that is what Texas Farm Bureau is already doing and will continue to do, is to press the need to get this farm bill done. That means that us on staff at Texas Farm Bureau are continually talking to our 40-member delegation, plus many other folks that are key decision makers in Washington. But we're also taking actual farmers from Texas up to D.C. Actually next week we'll be taking a handful to meet with some offices to tell them directly from the horse's mouth how farmers are being impacted. And so we've got a lot of work to do there. Now, as far as the Senate, we're hopeful that they act on this very soon, or at least if they're planning to do their own bill, roll that out as soon as possible, because we have no more time to waste.
There has been some talk about trying to protect Texas farmland from being overtaken by projects like the AI projects that are going on around. In fact, we talked to Sid Miller here recently on the West Texas Dispatch about that. Do you see a need for more restrictions?
Well, it depends. You know, we are definitely watching this as a national securities concern, but also a private property concern. With that, though, is private property rights. You know, if a farmer or rancher wants to sell their property, then obviously they're allowed to do that. Now, is this something that we need to be paying attention to as we look at agriculture as a whole and our food security as a whole? Absolutely. And Texas Farm Bureau is certainly doing that to make sure that we're watching this situation where a lot of data centers are going in and seeing that it is a lot of times on prime farmland. So it is definitely something that we must not take our eye off on, and we'll continue to be monitoring and trying to figure out, you know, what the solution would be for that.
Mr. Adams, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Laramie Adams is the Associate Director of Government Affairs for Texas Farm Bureau. The Farm Bill currently faces some pushback over the pesticide liability language and rules around some SNAP benefits, but it is headed to the full House for a vote before it would be considered by the Senate. We have seen some wild weather swings as we head into spring. We've got a look at what the whirlwind is all about. KACU's Heather Claiborne catches up on the systems we're seeing move through our region.
Mike Castillo, meteorologist in charge in the San Angelo National Weather Service office, thanks for joining us on the West Texas Dispatch.
Yes, good morning.
This past week or so, it has seemed like winter decided it was not going to go quietly. What a week for West Texas weather.
Yes, it has been. And so we've seen a roller coaster of temperatures. and so we've gone from one extreme to the other in the past week, where, you know, we had very unseasonably warm temperatures back to near normal to below normal temperatures with the cold air that moved down into our area. In addition, we've had some strong storms that have produced hail over portions of the big country with the last storm system we had. Fortunately, with the cold air that came down, we didn't have any storms develop with that. So that was a mostly dry front that went through just the other day. And so we didn't see any impacts as far as thunderstorms, which was nice not having to, you know, deal with any severe weather, but we did miss out on an opportunity for additional rainfall.
Tell us a little bit about the system itself. Where did it come from and what was driving it?
With this time of year, we're usually transitioning from frontal systems that are coming from Canada and bringing Arctic air down. We usually transition from those type of systems to more systems coming out from the West Coast, and those tend to bring more moist and not as cold air across our part of the state as we transition into spring. And so we've had a combination of both systems in the last week, where we had one system that was coming out from the West Coast. And so that brought a lot of moist and warm air across the area, and that contributed to the thunderstorms that developed prior to this last front. The front that we got the other day, that was more of a front coming from the north, from Canada. And so it's kind of unusual to flip back and forth and get one system coming from the north and one system from the west. But that's what we saw, and that's what we're going to see at least in the next week or so, is these transient systems either coming from the north or the west. But we'll see as we go more into the spring, less cold air coming in from the north, and more of the warm, moist air coming in from the west.
Well, as you alluded to earlier, we did start the week with some freezing temperatures in the early hours. And then by the end of this week, we're going to really be feeling the heat. What's going on?
Yeah, so we're in that transition where we're going to see more Pacific systems that are going to be developing. Typically what we see during the summer, we see these high pressure systems kind of set up across the south central United States, and that's going to warm temperatures more than normal for our region. So that is one of the contributing factors. We call them subtropical high pressure systems. When they develop, usually during the summer, they set up across the southwest and south central United States, and that is what we typically see during the summer, which contributes to the heat. We're going to see that this week, where that high pressure system is going to set up, and because of the sinking air associated with that high pressure system, it's going to provide a lot of subsidence across the area, and that's going to create the heating that we normally wouldn't see this time of year. And so the main reason we're going to see the above normal temperatures, you know, and possibly temperatures reaching, you know, near 100 degrees for the weekend, because of that sinking air mass that's going to be setting up across the region this weekend.
And does this indicate that we're going to have a really hot summer ahead?
Not necessarily, because a lot of things can change between now and the summer. And so we're looking at different factors. One of it is we're looking at the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is, you know, expected to be neutral this summer, but then possibly changing into a strong El Nino event. And so that's going to influence the weather patterns across the United States. And so depending on, you know, how that evolves during the summer months will impact the pressure systems across the United States. And so, you know, depending on how strong the El Nino develops this summer and when it develops may make the summer hotter than normal. But we won't know until that pattern develops later this year.
Well, Mike Castillo, meteorologist in charge for the San Angelo office of the National Weather Service, thank you so much for the work that you do keeping us safe and keeping us updated.
You're welcome.
As we celebrate 40 years of serving Abilene and the Big Country, we're bringing you updates on the students who made that service possible. Last week, we heard from a relatively recent member of our team. This week, we're going back a few more years to hear from Farron Hipp, formerly Farron Salee.
Congratulations, KACU, on celebrating 40 years. My name is Farron Hipp, although I was Farron Salee at the time that I worked there. I was hired to start at KACU in January 2009. This was the second semester of my freshman year, and I still remember like this was yesterday. My first day going into work, and I walked there, and I was so afraid going from the Nelson dorm to the station. It felt like an ungodly hour of the morning, first of all, but it's also just kind of dark and quiet and creepy on campus. Not only that, I was also just nervous because this was my first on-air job. This was a dream that I had that was finally being realized through KACU. Well, fast forward a little bit. I did always want to be a TV journalist, but I knew that audio, using that as a medium, was a way that I could really force myself to hone in on my dialect, diction, inflection, and tone. Those are all things that carried me throughout my career. And the first time that I was on the microphone at KACU, I thought I would change the world through my local news brief of Morning Edition. That wasn't exactly the case. I was told that I sound like a Southern cheerleader trying to read the news. I had a long way to go, but that was my first hard lesson, I guess you could say, tough love, straight talk that we get in the biz. It's hard to believe. It's been 17 years now since I started at KACU, but I learned there are much earlier shifts. I did go on to work as a morning reporter, as a morning anchor at several different newsrooms across the country. I've won 3 regional Emmy Awards, and I'm proud to say that I host a nationally syndicated talk show that is filmed in Tampa Bay, Florida. That's where I am now. And it all started with KACU. I'm so thankful and grateful to God for the journey that I had that started there, for so many people that nurtured me along the way, some that are not with us today, but that's why there's just so much value, and you can't really put a number or a price tag or a stamp or anything like that on it, because what KACU does for Abilene, for the students that work there, It's just amazing. And I thank you so much for all that you've done for me. Congratulations on 40 years and on 40 more great years to come.
Check out Farron Hip's video from KACU's 40th Flashbacks on our social media at KACU895. It's time for West Texas Roots. At February's Texas Farm, Ranch, and Wildlife Expo, we heard a lot of stories about horses and cattle. However, one animal in particular stuck out, and it's unbelievable. John Schrader told us a remarkable story of how he encountered a hive of bees trapped in a warehouse. His job was to get them out so the workers wouldn't be stung, but this was easier said than done. Fortunately for the workers, the bees were let outside safely and bumbled on to find a new hive.
Well, I got to be a Pied Piper of bees one day. I was asked to come out and attend to a bee control matter in a big warehouse. Inside that big warehouse was an office arrangement, and the folks in the office didn't want the bees coming in and stinging them inside there. They weren't too concerned about the workers in the warehouse, but they didn't want them in the office. So I came out and I looked and I looked, and I did not find a beehive anywhere. I just found bees wandering around everywhere inside that barn, warehouse. So looking at the situation, I had to ask myself, I really don't want to kill the bees. I'd have to fog the entire place to even try. I don't want to endanger employees. So I had to ask myself, why are the bees here? What do they want? Well, they were there because of an accidental traveling. They were looking for something and they just flew into an open warehouse door. Big door, big bunch of bees, they all flew in. Once they got in, there was just enough light inside there that they were confused and didn't know where to go now. So they just kept bumping into the walls of the warehouse. So I thought to myself, well, what do they want? They're not looking for food in here. There's no water in here. They have no hive. What are they looking for? A way out. So I asked, can we turn off all the lights? Sure. Can we shut the big doors? Sure. Can we open up this walk-through door? Okay. I said, well, go get a chair for us. So the two of us sat down in a chair on opposite sides of the door. We opened up the door, and for the next hour, we watched bees fly out. It was an amazing swarm of bees that were looking for their next hive, and they just happened to bumble into the wrong place. They know where the queen is. They go out, when they swarm, they generally are going out looking for a place to create a hive. When they find it, they'll go get her and bring her to it and say, now get busy. So yeah, they were worker bees just looking for food or looking for a new home, and they flew in a big open door and didn't know what to do now.
We recorded John Schrader's story of the bumbling bees at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. 325 Day is coming up next week. The day is named after Abilene's area code, if you hadn't put two and two together on that, and it is scheduled on March 25th. It gives local merchants a chance to celebrate being part of Abilene, usually by offering specials or unique items. Some of them designate their proceeds to benefit local nonprofits. Elizabeth Gray is the Community Development Officer with the Teachers Federal Credit Union, and she is here to tell us more about it. Elizabeth, welcome to the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So okay. Why have a 325 day?
Why not? That's the real question. Why not? Well, it really just began after the freeze in 2021, and we were just trying to come up with some fun, creative ideas to, you know, pull people out of the miry clay, basically. And so we did a social media campaign just saying, why do you like being a part of the 325? And then in 2022, we opened it up to the community and business owners, and they have jumped on board. So, yeah, why not?
Love it. How many local businesses are taking part in this? And can you name some?
Okay. So far, mm-hmm. We have about 70 businesses signed up so far. But I know an email blast is going out this afternoon, so there will probably be more. And we have businesses. We have boutiques. We have some restaurants. We have nonprofits. Carpet companies, The Leaf, KLS Boutique, the winery at Willow Creek. We have some faithfuls that participate every year, and then every year we have new people sign up as well, which is really exciting.
We know, for example, the Doubletree is offering street taco drink specials.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some of the other kind of unique things that people came up with for 325 Day.
Yeah. So, yes, the Doubletree is doing from 3 to 5. They're doing $3.25 street tacos, Woo. Sangrias, and a beer, I believe. And then the Leaf is doing a 3-pack sample box. I don't know what you call those.
Mm-hmm.
But 3 cigars for $25. And they have partnered with Habitat for Humanity. And so they're going to give 32.5% of the proceeds from that pack that are bought that day to Habitat for Humanity.
That's great.
Yeah.
So that was my next question is, can you talk about, because there's several of these businesses mm-hmm. that are teaming up with nonprofits. How does that work?
Yes. Yeah, so I have wanted to somehow incorporate that for a good while now. And this is the first year that we've kind of started encouraging businesses to partner with a nonprofit of their choice. So, you know, the winery, they do a lot for All Kind. And so they're having a pet adoption that day from 3 to 5. And then they're having a whole bunch of specials and stuff as well, and going to have live music and a food truck and all that from 5 to 8, I believe. And then 7-in-1 Books has partnered with Women of Outstanding Achievement, and she is selling books for community members to go in and buy this specific Brené Brown book. She's hoping to sell 33 because she said we couldn't cut a book in half to sell 32.5. And then she is going to donate them to our scholarship applicants for Women of Outstanding Achievement. You know, some people are donating proceeds and some people are just partnering in different ways. And it's really cool to see how people are partnering up.
So I wake up in the morning mm-hmm. and I'm sitting here thinking, what am I going to do with the family today? How am I going to celebrate this day? What are some ways to find out what's going on in the area?
So go to our website, 325day.com. We have all the businesses listed. We have tabs so you can kind of search for what you want. You can also go to our social media page, Celebrate 325 Day. We post all of the businesses and what they're doing. I know Frontier Texas is participating, the Grace, the Nickel. So there's a lot of family-friendly things. There's restaurants, and I think Peacock Patio is about to sign up. I don't know what they're going to do, but that's a fun, you know, adult night out.
It is.
So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of things going on that day.
And let me also add that our friends at Monk's Downtown, the coffee shop, they are donating a portion of their proceeds to 89.5 KACU. All right, 325 Day is coming up. When again is that?
It's on 325.
You know, when I was a kid, our area code was 915.
Yes.
So it could have been in September, but we're glad it's in March.
Yes. El Paso celebrates 915 Day.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. All right. Elizabeth Gray, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Gray is the Community Development Officer with the Abilene Teachers Federal Credit Union. You can find all the information, check out the businesses participating, and plan your day by going to 325day at 325day.com. Tomorrow, Texans can celebrate the arrival of warm weather and the first day of spring with a free ice cream cone. KACU's Bailey Simon has the details.
Free Cone Day is Dairy Queen's official welcome party for spring and the warmer weather ahead. Customers can get a free small vanilla cone, and some locations will charge $1 for a dipped cone. Funds from dipped cones and additional donations will go to the Children's Miracle Network, a nonprofit organization that raises funds for 170 hospitals across the U.S. and Canada. Whitney Crane manages two Dairy Queen locations in Abilene. She says her stores won't charge for a dipped cone, but will still encourage customers to make donations. Ann Crane says donations made in Abilene will stay in Abilene.
We mainly work with Hendricks Hospital. So all the donations that we raise go towards buying everything for children with needs at hospitals such as Hendricks.
Hendricks has had a partnership with the Children's Miracle Network since 1989. Crane says last year, the East Ambler location gave away around 700 cones.
At one of our other locations here in town in Mockingbird, they had the best year, and I want to say, and I could be wrong, that it was somewhere around 3,000. So it's pretty awesome.
Most Dairy Queen locations in Abilene open at 10 a.m. and close between 10 and 11 p.m. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, let them know they can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on that KACU mobile app. We had some help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, as well as producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.